This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney.
I've just done everything that I can do. I've done my best. We have to run through the tape. Make no mistake about it. We're not quitting until we turn off the lights, because we have so many things to do.
Governor Kasich delivers his State of the State speech. Democratic Representative Dan Ramos says the governor needed more action behind his words.
Okay, but you've been in charge for 8 years now with your party in control of both houses, and let's see those policies, because unfortunately the same problems we had then we still have now.
We'll analyze Governor Kasich's final State of the State address and reaction to it. Also on today's weekly news review, Cincinnati City Council gets an update on the state of the streetcar, and an audit questions some of the overtime paid to Cincinnati police officers last year. Joining me first to delve into the State of the State speech and other Ohio news, Ohio Public Radio's Karen Kassler. Good afternoon, Karen.
Hi, good afternoon.
And also WVXU's Howard Wilkinson. Hi, Howard.
Mark, how are you?
Good, thanks. And you can join us, 513-419-7100, email talk@wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. So, Karen, how do you describe this final State of the State speech for Governor Kasich?
Well, I think there are people who would describe it as uplifting and positive. There are other people who would describe it as wacky and weird. He described it himself as odd and different. He had warned us last week that the speech was not going to be what maybe we had seen out of other speeches that he's given. This would be his last one, his eighth one. And I think all those things are true. I mean, it certainly had a lot of positive tones in the speech. I think, you know, if you like John Kasich for that kind of approach where he talks about bringing people together and seeing the good side of things and helping others and that sort of thing, there was that in the speech. But the other side, the rambling nature of it, how it kind of veered off in different directions, how it really didn't have a strong message and had no specifics on policy and what he plans to do with his last couple of months in office, that was definitely missing. So if you don't like John Kasich, that's the kind of stuff that you might be looking at.
Yeah, and he went into some national issues as well in the speech, right?
A lot of national stuff, and I think that's another thing that people could point at. Both the people who like Kasich and want to see him run for national office are looking at that, but people who feel like he should be back here in Ohio doing more here in Ohio are pointing to that and saying this speech was a national speech. It wasn't a speech. It wasn't the state of the state of Ohio. It was something else. It was maybe a launch for a political future, which at the end he kind of hinted that, hey, I'm going to run through the tape. The finish line's so far away, I can't see it yet. There are a lot of people who would disagree and feel like that he's already gone past the finish line in his own mind.
You know, I think another adjective that some people might apply to this was whiny, too, because there was a little whininess in it. You know, and Democrats pointed us out afterwards, said, look, you know, you've been governor for almost 8 years now, and you've had complete control of your party's had complete control of the state government and the legislature. And if things haven't gotten done, you haven't achieved things, whose fault is that? Who's to blame?
He said there at the end that, you know, he's done his best. But yeah, that's an interesting point to bring out, that if indeed Republicans have run everything, which they have, then why might there be things that he wanted to get done that didn't get done? And certainly you could point to his relationship with the legislature not being the best. Mm-hmm. And I think that's part of the reason why he didn't get into a whole lot of specifics of things he wanted to do on his way out the door, because I think there's a good chance he's not going to be able to get some of those things done.
And Howard, is there ever much that any governor, when they're giving that final State of the State speech, is there ever really anything that comes out of those types of speeches, final ones?
I don't know. I mean, it's hard for anybody who is a lame duck governor to influence legislation that's coming down the pike unless they have a legislature which is in tune with them. And they've been singing out of a different hymnal in the state legislature for some time now. And it's highly unlikely they're going to change their tune between now and the time John Kasich leaves office.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And I think coming behind him, if there are two Republicans who are running, Mike mm-hmm. DeWine and Mary Taylor, and neither one of them seem to be all that interested in embracing Kasich's legacy, specifically on Medicaid expansion, but in other areas. And so I think that kind of sets up he really is very lame as a lame duck in that respect. I mean, you've got Mary Taylor. She was there in the audience as his lieutenant governor, and she tweeted out a one-word response. Huh. Which, you know, I'm not sure how she wanted us all to take it. There's been lots of interpretations.
Yeah, right.
There's been an interpretation. Was it sarcastic? Was she unimpressed? I mean, it seemed that she was unimpressed by a one-word response. But it was very interesting to see his former—I mean, she was his running mate and sitting there in this during the speech with that kind of a response.
So what were some of the things he did talk about? I mean, did he talk about dealing with the opioid crisis in the state?
He did. He talked a little bit about, and here's an area where the few facts that he did bring out deserve some fact checking. And this is one place where you can do some fact checking. He said that prescription painkiller, the actual prescriptions for opioid-based painkillers have dropped off in Ohio. That is absolutely true. They have dropped off. But then he went on to say that heroin has leveled off. That is not true. I mean, what we're seeing from the Department of Health and other preliminary reports for the numbers for last year really show that we're rising in terms of deadly overdose deaths from heroin, from fentanyl, from other drugs that are coming mixed with fentanyl, like cocaine and meth. And so that was really a statement that that you could say, hey, that's not true. He didn't talk much about some of the other things that I think a lot of people wanted to hear him speak about, the gun reform proposals that he came out with. One of those areas where he might have a little trouble getting past the legislature. He did mention only briefly this plan to overhaul education, which would bring K-12, secondary education, higher ed, and workforce development into one big agency. He really didn't talk about that. You know, he didn't even talk about congressional redistricting, which was a thing that will be on the ballot in May, and it was considered a big deal. Arnold Schwarzenegger was here last week at this time doing a toast with state lawmakers about how great it was that this has been worked out and going to go to voters. He didn't mention any of those things.
Yeah, it seems like he could have talked about these things in really strong terms. And just gone out with a bang and said, you know, it's up to you folks. You folks
in the mention,
sure, you think at this point he's got the high ground. He can say a lot of things at this point, yeah.
Right.
He did mention that we're going to get a new state park. That was one big
piece
of news. Well,
that's good
because
I like state parks, but, you know, that's...
Yeah, tell us about that state park. It's going to be named for the Olympic great Jesse Owens, as I understand it.
Right. And it's out in, I think, eastern Ohio. And, this is kind of a legacy piece, I think, because by the time it actually is passed and really kind of put together, he mentioned that it would be Ohio's largest state park and kind of left it as a thing that will happen after he's gone. I guess it was news to the State Parks Department, the ODNR, that they weren't necessarily expecting him to make that announcement. So that was the one piece of news, I think, that we can point to here.
Yeah, and that's one of those things that we'll see, you know, if no matter who's elected governor, this year, if they pick up on that and carry that.
Karen, did he say exactly where this park would be located?
He didn't say in the speech. I think it's in Muskingum and Coshocton counties out in eastern Ohio.
Right.
I'm having a hard time exactly figuring out where it is just because I don't know that part of the state that well.
Yeah,
so.
It's kind of out there in the John Glenn land, in John Glenn territory. Well, it is. I mean, you know, Muskingum, Coshocton, all that area around there.
But it's certainly an area. I mean, that's Appalachian, Ohio.
Oh,
that's
yes.
an area that could certainly
absolutely.
Use some dollars with regard to tourism and just kind of the unemployment rate is higher in Appalachian, Ohio. So that's
because Shockton County's been chronically had a chronic unemployment problem.
Yeah, and so I don't think nobody's going to complain about a new state park. I don't think so. That was
a softball. That was easy.
Yeah.
But
exactly.
That was the most specific thing that we got out of this speech. Then is what you're telling me.
I think so, unless you consider the philosophy and history lesson that it started out as, which
how philosophical did he get?
he got really philosophical. I mean, for a half an hour, he started out talking about Westerville and really getting very sentimental because it's his adopted hometown.
And he was talking about what happened with the police officers in Westerville, too, wasn't he?
Yeah. Right. There were two police officers who were killed last month in Westerville, and the whole community has really rallied around those officers' families and really tried to show their support. Then he went on to talk about philosophers, went through a whole laundry list of everybody from Plato to Camus to Kierkegaard. I mean, this whole list. And then started going into kind of a sermon almost, talking about the people who are the least among us, that sort of thing. And I think it's really interesting. Every year when after he decided to start taking his show on the road, so to speak, and not doing the State of the State here in the State House, we were always trying to figure out why he picked the places that he picked. And this one, I feel like, is the most obvious, based on the speech, that he picked a small liberal arts college in his adopted hometown that is affiliated with the Methodist Church.
Yes,
I think that really indicated what his speech was like.
Right. I agree.
Yeah, and Karen was talking earlier about how he's laying the groundwork for what's next after this particular office. Do you feel like that's what he's doing, 2 hours?
Well, yeah, I do. The problem is I don't think he actually knows himself. You know, when he says that he has everything's on the table, all of my options are on the table, that's true. They all are. And I don't think he's made up his mind yet exactly what it is he wants to do. He'd like to be president.
I think a lot of people, right.
But then it becomes a matter of how do you become president? Do you run against Donald Trump?
Do you think
he
might switch parties?
Well, no, you don't have to switch parties. I mean, you could
form
your own
party. Primary, but okay.
I mean, you could form your own party and
so be an independent of some kind.
Some fat cat like Michael Bloomberg to finance your campaign and be your running mate and run as an independent candidate. But you could do that, but it would probably almost assure that Donald Trump would be reelected, because that kind of a ticket would be taking more votes away from whoever the Democratic nominee is than it would be from Donald Trump, probably.
And I think it's interesting, one thing that I want to drop in, that in this week coming up, Tom Steyer, who's a Democratic donor from California who's been running ads about impeaching Donald Trump, mm-hmm. he is starting a whole series of town hall meetings. This man has spent millions of dollars on this ad campaign, going to spend a lot of money on these 30 town halls around the country. His first town hall is going to be this coming week in Columbus. And I think it's interesting because that's the kind of person potentially that people could look at and point to John Kasich and Tom Steyer and say, could these two people get together? I mean, is there potentially something there? And so I'm interested to find out about that.
So we get the State of the State speech this week, Karen, and then meantime, you've also got the Democratic candidates for governor who met, I think this was what, their first debate for this year?
Well, it's their first debate of this particular group. This was actually the fourth debate. The fourth of the series, the first one that's really been the marquee one, because the three previous debates all last year featured the candidates who were running last year, which were Joe Schiavone, Nan Whaley, Connie Pillich, and Betty Sutton. Well, now the field has narrowed. Those three female candidates, those three women are out. They've all thrown their support behind Richard Cordray, including Betty Sutton, who's actually joined his ticket as lieutenant governor. And then this particular group was Joe Schiavone, Richard Cordray, Bill O'Neill, and Dennis Kucinich. So this was really kind of a real preview, I think, of the four contenders for the May primary.
Yeah, it's kind of morphed its way into basically an all-male group.
In defense, two of them have female running mates.
True,
women
absolutely.
Running mates. But yeah, the debate has really dramatically changed from three women and one man in the three previous debates to all men.
Yeah.
And if I'm remembering correctly, Karen, Joe Schiavone was the first Democrat in the race, and he's still hanging in there.
Yes. And actually, I just misspoke. Actually, three of the four Democratic candidates who were on that stage have women as running mates. So there's that. So it really is a dramatic change. And like I said, this is really what I think a lot of people expect to have in terms of the four candidates who are going to be on the May ballot. And what I thought was really interesting, I think a lot of people expected this to be the Dennis Kucinich and Richard Cordray show, that it was going to be the two of them going at it. Dennis Kucinich had really blasted Cordray at the City Club of Cleveland last month, specifically for his support for a state law that overrode local ordinances on guns. When he was Attorney General, Richard Cordray had actually defended that state law in court and had been pleased with the outcome. And that's not what happened, though, in Toledo at this debate on Wednesday. It was really more Bill O'Neill than anybody else who really went at Richard Cordray, calling him Prince Richard and saying that the party had picked him and anointed him and given him all this money. And really, you know, Bill O'Neill's had a longstanding dispute with the party that he represents for a while, going back to when P.G. Sittenfeld ran against Ted Strickland in 2016. But it was very interesting to watch this attack.
Yeah, I'm curious. How did Richard Cordray respond to that?
Well, I think
he handled it?
I think he felt almost a little cornered in a way, because this was, I think, a little bit of a surprise to him as well, because, you know, I think a lot of people have not taken Bill O'Neill all that seriously as a candidate. I mean, he was a late entry. He'd done some kind of wacky things in terms of bragging on Facebook that he'd had sex with 50 women, you know, some of this other stuff.
And Cordray took him to task for that, too.
Absolutely. Said it was disgusting and inappropriate. But I think all of them.
Yes.
I think it took a little while for Cordray to kind of come to his own defense here, but he has been, and has said, with regard to the idea of him being the anointed candidate, he feels like he's earning his support. He's proud to have gotten some of the union support he's gotten already. And Bill O'Neill really took the union, has said that it just was inappropriate to do that before the primary. But, you know, that's kind of setting this whole thing up here, that this struggle among these four candidates to try to figure out who's going to actually prevail. I mean, whoever wins this primary is probably going to win with a lot less than 50%, which is pretty extraordinary when you consider they're going to have to go up against a Republican Party that's been very well organized and has typically turned out more in these off-year elections than Democrats have.
I don't know if you probably noticed this too, Karen, that Prince Richard has already been picked up by the Republican Governors Association, and they're starting to pound away at that. So, I mean, he gave them a line to use, which is, you know.
Well, and that's the thing about primaries in general is, I think a lot of people don't like them because they do feed the other side as you're headed toward the general election. Yeah. So, but, you know, Democrats have said, and Republicans also say too, that the primaries make the candidates stronger. They get these issues out there. They allow people to discuss them. And then people, the voters, get to decide who is actually going to represent the party, not the party deciding. And so this is on full display here.
It's got some weird numbers to all this thing. You know, like Karen says, I mean, you're not going to have to win in a majority, just some kind of a plurality probably to win this thing. In terms of Bill O'Neill, to me, it's just almost, if any Democratic woman out there has been paying it any attention at all, I can't imagine he's going to get a whole lot of the women vote, which is a very substantial part of the Democratic coalition.
Well, I will say, though, that, you know, when O'Neill was called up on this Facebook post, he profusely apologized.
He did.
Said that he was wrong, that's an interesting approach. You don't often hear somebody in a position running for office apologize, saying, I made a mistake. I'm sorry. I mean, I think there are some people who are hoping that Cordray will actually step up and say something like that with regard to his endorsement from the NRA back in 2010, mm-hmm. when he was running for re-election for Attorney General. That's, I think, for some Democrats, a little problematic given what's going on right now with regard to school shootings and violence and that sort of thing. I think Cordray is still looking for the right way to express his relationship with gun owners and people who are strong supporters of the Second Amendment, because he has been a strong supporter of the Second Amendment.
Well, he's got a kind of a Ted Strickland problem here with us, you know. Had the same kind of problems.
Hey, Karen, you know, considering the track record for Ohio's Democratic Party in statewide races in recent years, Is there any talk around all this of figuring out some way to unify the party?
Well, I mean, I think that's going to be the challenge. And, you know, it's so funny because that's the challenge that we talked about in 2016 for Republicans and Democrats. Now we're talking about it here. I mean, I think when you deal with a primary, you're dealing with the extremes on both sides, left and right. And it's really going to depend on who turns out to vote in May, which candidate you get, because arguably there are extremes on both the Republican ticket and the Democratic ticket. So whoever is going to be the nominee is really going to have to struggle with that, especially if they are considered to be one of those extremes. I mean, you look at the Republican ticket where Mary Taylor is really running very, very hard to the right of Mike DeWine. And in the Democratic side, you've got Dennis Kucinich running very hard to the left against Richard Cordray. And it really seems like Bill O'Neill is doing the same thing, running kind of alongside Dennis Kucinich, though he disagrees with him maybe on a couple of things. But he seems to be very close to Kucinich in his viewpoints on things like marijuana and some of these other issues.
One of the big differences between the Democratic field and the Republican field is the Democratic field is, as we said, they've had debates where they've all stood on stage and talked about the issues. The Republicans haven't done that. Mike DeWine will not do that with Mary Taylor because he's not going to give her that kind of a platform.
And I interviewed him this week for our TV show, The State of Ohio. Yeah. The interview with Mike DeWine airs next week. And I specifically asked him, are you going to debate Mary Taylor? And he gave me an answer that made it sound like he would, but I think he feels like that he's already done some of that. And honestly, he has nothing to gain from a debate because he's doing so much more in terms of fundraising and his numbers are better in terms of polling that he has no reason to debate her. And that's likely why it won't happen.
Right.
So the Republicans, no scheduled debates?
There won't be. It's like Karen says, there's no reason for Mike DeWine to debate Mary Taylor
and honestly,
in any forum whatsoever.
And it's been a long time since Mike DeWine debated anybody. So
right. Sure.
I think, you know, whenever the debate, if he does indeed prevail and becomes the nominee, it will be very interesting to see him actually flex those skills again against a Democratic candidate who has possibly been debating a couple of times before even the primary.
Mm-hmm. Now, Karen, you were talking about this earlier. There's a plan to overhaul Ohio's education system that is out there. I think House Republicans introduced this. As I understand it, it's going to hand control of the education department to the governor.
Yes.
Why? Now, what's the thinking behind this? Why do they want to do that?
Well, this is something that governors have wanted for a long time. The whole idea of right now on the state school board, there are appointed members and there are elected members. And governors have always wanted to have more control because governors do quite often run on education policy as one of their platforms. And it's very hard to claim a victory or to be judged on a policy when you don't have more control and authority. So I think they've wanted to have this. But then, of course, the pushback of that is, do we want to get into a situation where the policy could potentially change every 4 to 8 years when we get a new governor? Do we want somebody to have that kind of control over such an important thing in Ohio? And so I think that that's a lot of the discussion that we're seeing right now. I mean, there are a lot of groups who are very concerned about this proposal to bring K through 12 and higher ed and workforce development all into one big agency, and who would actually be in charge, who would be setting the policy, how would workforce development actually be connected to education, how would all this work? And I think over the next couple of weeks, we're really going to see some discussions about that. There's going to be a series of statewide forums that are going to be held at different parts around the state with State School Superintendent Paula DeMaria and other people talking about what this bill would actually do. It's kind of a legacy bill, though, if Kasich does get it through, because it won't affect him. It would affect whoever the next governor and governors will be.
And how much is is the strong opposition from groups that represent a lot of different perspectives and a lot of different angles? I think that's one of the interesting aspects of this whole story.
Well, I mean, you've got, you know, obviously the school groups, you've got local elected board members who are very concerned about how this, they feel, would take power away from the state school board and really put it in the hands of the governor. You've got homeschooling groups. You've got, there are a lot of different
teachers
organizations.
Teachers
public school
unions,
advocates,
yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think over the next couple of weeks, you're going to see these conversations from these groups as they all come to testify, many of them against this proposal, but some of them for it, to try to figure out where they end up falling in terms of whether they support this or not. This just seems like such a big, big thing to try to get through in a lame duck legislature. You know, I doubt that any vote could possibly come on. I mean, they're going to go on break here around Memorial Day. I just wonder if this is going to be something that would be voted on before that.
Also, Karen, there's a new bill on sexual harassment, and I wonder if you can explain what this one would do.
Yeah, this is a bill that was sponsored by State Senator Charlita Tavares, who's a Republican. I'm sorry, excuse me. She's a Democrat from Columbus. She's a longtime state House person. She started here as an aide, and she's been in the House and Senate. And she is very concerned about the continued incidents of sexual harassment and reports of all sorts of inappropriate behavior. She wrote a letter a couple of months back basically telling her colleagues, her Republican colleagues in the legislature, that sexual harassment training wasn't enough, that there needed to be more to try to make the state house a better workplace environment for women. This was signed by only Democratic lawmakers and Democratic lawmakers staff members. No Republican women signed on to this. No Republicans signed on to it. Now she's proposed legislation that would step up those requirements and really kind of make it a little bit tougher. But, you know, right now she doesn't have Republican support. She has no support from leadership. And so it's kind of one of those things that you look at and think this might not have a big chance to be pushed forward, especially Democrats are in the super minority in both the House and the Senate. So they really need Republican support to get anything through.
And Governor Kasich didn't even mention this during the State of the State. So
he mentioned the sexual harassment.
Not this bill, though, right?
No, he mentioned it on the national level, Hollywood, and it mentioned sexual harassment, you know, kind of hinting at Harvey Weinstein and that kind of stuff. But he didn't mention anything, any of the stories about, you know, we've had a resignation of a state senator. We've had a resignation of a state representative. We've had all these stories about inappropriate behavior, and Kasich didn't mention any of that.
Karen and Howard, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
It's great to be with you.
Yeah.
Ohio Public Radio's Karen Kassler and WVXU's Howard Wilkinson. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Joining me from the Cincinnati Inquirer, Sharon Coolidge. Hi, Sharon.
Hi.
And Dan Horn. Hi, Dan.
Hi.
And you can be part of the conversation, 513-419-7100. You can email talk at WVXU.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. So, Sharon, what is going on at the Cincinnati Police Department? This has been a week of turmoil, from what I've been reading.
You know, honestly, I was sitting at my desk on Monday working on some streetcar stuff because that was what the beginning of this week was.
And because they had the state of the streetcar address this week.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And an EEOC complaint kind of fell into our laps. And I was like, I hadn't heard anything that was like being alleged in it or anything. And it was kind of a big surprise. And Dan ended up writing about that.
Yeah, an EEOC complaint, Dan. So this is an Equal Employment Opportunity Commission complaint?
Correct. Okay. Captain Bridget Bardua, who is a commander at District 5, filed an EEOC complaint alleging sexual discrimination against a number of high-ranking officials in the police department. And the root of this was that there was an audit done and that she felt she was being singled out for unfair treatment based on the fact that she's a woman and on the fact that she supports Police Chief Elliot Isaac. At that time, we didn't know details about this audit. We knew it existed, but we hadn't seen it. And we were kind of at a loss to explain further exactly what the basis for this dispute was.
And I had heard that there had been like an overtime audit going on. This goes all the way back to Chief Blackwell.
Yeah, there's so many layers in this thing. It's amazing.
Who had been fired. And so during that time, there was a lot of things going on, and it was discovered that there were some overtime issues under his watch, and that prompted the city to do an audit.
And this is back in what, 2016? 2015.
So we're all the way back there. The city does an audit, releases the finding in 2016, says overtime is a big mess, and 16 recommendations. Everything from oversight, better computer systems, and how you need to do things. The police department responds and they say, you're right, we do need to keep better tabs on this. And we're going to start doing two audits a year ourselves and keep track of this. And that's, I thought there would be like big findings in it. And it was like, no, it was more like, here's the process going forward. Well, here we are, and this is the process. They did an audit, and they say it isn't completed. I think that it is completed.
and they're still having problems.
And I've written about it at this point on Tuesday. So now I write about that on Tuesday.
So they looked at what, $7 million in overtime from last year, and then they're questioning not the whole $7 million, but a chunk of it.
Yeah, the audit looked at the idea is to do kind of a random sampling throughout the department to get an idea of where they're at and to look at the overall big picture on what overtime is and where it's at. And as Sherry said, the day after the EEOC complaint was filed, we started to get information about the audit. And so we started writing about that. And in the audit, you can see that there are some specifics in there. But, overall, they were about $1.8 million over their total overtime budget. There's some reasons for that. But then when you look into the nitty gritty is where you start to see some of the issues that they were raising about District 5 and where some of this dispute over the EEOC complaint arose. And you start connecting dots and you can see that, you know, she was clearly upset with the fact that she felt she was being singled out in that audit. We could see some of the numbers there. And obviously, things spiraled from there on Wednesday.
And how does overtime work? I mean, do officers on the beat, they have theirs capped, and then if you're above a certain rank, then it isn't capped anymore. Is that correct, Sharon?
It's so complicated. Okay. It's like, you know, they're allowed to work details, and there has to be time between them. And if they go to court, they're allowed a certain amount of time, even if they only spend so much time there. And it's capped for patrol officers. Honestly, it's different for every structure.
Right. And in the audit, you can see they are two primary ways they're collecting overtime. They get overtime pay, and then there's also compensatory time, which is basically banked time that they can take either time off or collect pay at some point in the future. In this case, that total figure of over $7 million accounted for both of those figures, I believe.
Yes. Yes. So now, the next morning, I mean, I kind of thought that the reaction would be to the audit.
Okay, let's get this lined up first. We have the audit, then we have the captain's complaint attached to the audit, and then what comes next? Have I got it in the right order?
Actually, the complaint came first.
Complaint
mentions
first, and
the
then
audit.
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 Okay, and then?
The next day, the city manager was very upset, and there was a string of early morning emails that were shared with me, and in them, he complains that there are rogue elements within the police department that are corrupt and working to undermine him and the police chief. And I honestly was kind of shocked by that. I didn't know where that was coming from because I thought we were going to talk about the audit numbers.
Wow. Okay. So he comes out with this comment, and then we have one of the it was the second in command who left yesterday. Who
Dave
left
Bailey on the department.
Wow.
Almost.
My head is spinning, Sharon.
I know.
This is amazing.
You know what? I'm going to direct everyone right now to Cincinnati.com. We did a who's who in all the players and who they are and how they kind of fit together and a timeline of how this all came together. So we realize that it's very complicated, a lot of moving parts, and we feel like both of those things are going to help people.
Yeah, and since you're doing that, I'll say Jay Hanselman at WVXU.org wrote a good synopsis of what's going on, so you can read about it at either site.
And he knows all the players. He's been around a while.
Okay, but continue.
So the city manager's upset, saying there's insubordination, and the next thing we hear is that Dave Bailey, he's being offered a buyout, and he's kind of being pinpointed for some things, and also a shock.
Although the city manager would later say that, you know, he did not, he was not referring
to Dave
Bailey.
He was not referring to him in the rogue elements comment.
Right. Okay. But the next day we're having that conversation, and so it becomes pretty complicated and confusing. I think what one takeaway that anyone who's been paying attention to this would have is that, you know, this audit didn't come out of the blue, and this tension didn't come out of the blue. There's clearly been some sort of tension at the high levels of the police department for some time. And this complaint and audit and what happened this week kind of put it over the edge, and now it's bubbling up into the public view.
And so they basically said, you need to take a buyout or you're going to get fired. And he didn't have much of a choice there.
Yeah.
And so this morning there was an agreement signed in which he is he's basically going to be paid for the next 2.5 years until it's time for him to retire so he can collect his full pension, but he will need to stay home and his police powers will be suspended, which that's a deal worth roughly $400,000.
Okay, so is there anything else at this point, or is that as far as we've gotten at this point?
The only thing I would say is I don't have a full explanation of why they're doing this. Yes, we had the rogue element comment, and of course you want to put everything together. It's in this, but you know, they're not actually putting it all together themselves, and there's no real explanation.
Right. If that's not the reason for the buyout, what is the reason for the buyout? I mean, what prompted that to follow the uproar we saw on Monday and Tuesday?
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join the conversation with Dan Horn and Sharon Coolidge. Do you have an idea, any hint of actual factions in the department? I mean, is there any proof of what the city manager is saying?
You know, I've really been paying a lot of attention to how the patrol officers are feeling. There was a hostile work environment under Jeffrey Blackwell. Things were very bad and people were upset. And that's just not, a great working condition. And I've been hearing like really good things. People like Chief Isaac. It seems like this command structure was popular. I mean, Dave Bailey, Newdigate, they do a lot of the work and they're the people kind of out in the community and dealing with the media and on these big kind of projects and crimes. And I thought things in the lower ranks were fairly good. But I mean, this clearly all this documentation doesn't happen overnight.
Right. And even city manager Harry Black was saying that, this is not an indication of the police department's overall performance. I believe on Wednesday or Thursday said that he considers the police department stellar and it's among the best in the country. The crime numbers are pretty good this year. So a lot of this is happening, separate apart from what's happening on the streets. A lot of this is a command structure issue and a personality issue, apparently, that, we aren't necessarily privy to all of that. But something clearly has been bubbling under the surface for some time here, and this audit and this complaint just brought it out. Mm.
So what's been the reaction from the mayor, from city council members? What have they had to say about this?
Well, the mayor was shocked, and he asked, and under the city structure, Harry makes the decisions about the day-to-day and personnel. The mayor was surprised. He was upset. He asked Harry to reconsider. Harry did not do that. And the mayor called it sad, and the police union president, Dan Hills, who's had his own issues with the mm-hmm. city manager, also upset, asked Harry to reconsider through the media because they don't talk. And they just, Harry, he stuck by his decision.
It's a pretty extraordinary chain of events to see this type of dynamic play out publicly. I mean, these tough conversations go on all the time in any organization and certainly in one that can be politicized like City Hall. But to see it play out the way it played out and in such a public way is unusual. And I think that's what surprised a lot of people inside and outside of City Hall and the police department this week.
I would say, too, one of the reasons why people should pay attention, because a lot of times I try and think about things like, what are people seeing? Like, we're talking about street paving. People want to know potholes. They want to know what's affecting their lives. And it is the policing that affects their lives, and that seems fine. But if you go back over to City Hall, we had a big streetcar discussion this week. There's lots of issues. But all anyone is doing is dealing with the politics of all of this. Like, that's the focus right now over at City Hall, instead of things that you may want City Hall people to be doing, or like, we're heading towards a budget that has a deficit of more than $20 million. But instead, we're political.
Yeah, it's an amazing story. There's so many layers to it. I guess that's what makes this so complicated.
It is, but it's good to know, you guys send Jay over there. I go over there a lot. It's good to know the players and what's going on, because so you can see why decisions are being made, like who's getting along with who, and it informs when things are being voted on and decisions are being made. And, some people, so of course now we're kind of like dividing down the lines. David Mann was very disappointed. He could not believe this kind of money was being used at a buyout without any discussion with council. But we're also seeing some other members, supporting the city manager, saying he's doing a good job.
And let's not forget that there is an audit that found serious problems with the way the police department handles its overtime. I mean, that's kind of gotten lost in the explosion that followed the release of that audit and all of the politics that followed it.
Yeah, what's likely to come of that? I mean, new policies or any changes on the horizon because of this?
Not at this time. I mean, that's something that the city administration and the police department are going to have to talk about and figure out, you know, if they agree there is a problem, and if so, how serious is that problem? And if there is one, how do you deal with it? And none of that right now, publicly anyway, is being talked about. We're right now talking a lot about the politics that followed it.
And then the EEOC sexual discrimination complaint. I mean, where's that going? When's that likely to be settled?
That could take a lot of time, months, year. You know, the first step is for the EEOC to evaluate and decide if they have to do a formal investigation. So until that happens, you know, we won't even have an idea of a timeline. But that is not done in a very public way. So until, you know, this marches forward a while, we won't know. But it could be many months or more than a year before a case like that's resolved.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join us. And Sharon, you mentioned the streetcar, that they got a state of the streetcar update this week. What was the message there?
You know, the structure is not working, the management structure. Honestly,
what is
not
the management structure,
secret.
By the way? What is the management
it's
structure,
so
by the
convoluted.
Way?
It's so convoluted. This was the city's idea. The city has a contract with the streetcar vehicle maker, and they're not working. There's a lot of problems there. And the
yeah,
city's
a lot of
kind
of product
of,
problems.
The city's in charge of that. You know, problem set. Then SORTA, our transit agency, like many places I might add around the country, has been hired to oversee the project. And they have some say, and they have a contract with the actual operator named TransDev, who also has a lot of problems.
Yeah, staffing, if I understand.
They do.
Is,
or
is
they
a
were in our
for them.
I mean, the streetcar is in, I don't know, a year and a half. It's been running and with very poor ridership, I might add. And they, you know, are struggling to keep staff. And, you know, at one point, the cars were not working at all in January, and they had no maintenance workers on staff to even fix them. And they were running a bus on the streetcar route in January.
So management's one of the big problems that the streetcar is facing, because you've got three organizations,
yes,
that are involved in this. Okay.
And it's like, you don't know, I forget, somebody said, the former president of Cincinnati Bell, whose name is on the project, you don't know whose neck to choke, which kind of was the headline out of the hearing. And, you know, but the truth of the matter is the structure does need to be fixed. Councilman Greg Landsman is in charge of the committee overseeing the streetcar now, and he has pledged fixes. And so this was his first state of the streetcar. We have three new council members. Bring it in. Let's talk about it. He has promised fixes, and we're looking forward to seeing what those are.
So ridership's down. How are revenues looking for the streetcar? If ridership's down, they can't be too
it's
doing
all,
too well.
It's all like a chain reaction, because I took a look at the budget and the ridership. The ridership, first of all, we charge for the streetcar. And the ticket machines, there's a lot of issues with them. They're mostly fixed. But that makes the process, puts up a barrier. So there's too few riders, so the fares are coming in less. Too few riders. There's not the advertising that it's supposed to be. I mean, I rode the streetcar last week on Tuesday night, and there were two advertisements in the car. A lot of blank space that used to have ads in it and a big Rosa Parks welcome sign, which was a lovely sign. But it was advertising space that didn't seem to be an advertisement.
Do we know if the streetcar has spurred any economic development, or how much it's spurred at this point?
It absolutely has spurred economic development. And for everyone who says, I never talk about that, here I am.
Sherry's actually saying it.
If you have eyes, of course it has. I mean, honestly, look at the top of Elm Street. I go up Elm a lot because the Enquirer is on Elm. I mean, it is amazing to see what's going on, like north of on Elm Street. And that's because of the streetcar. It's not anyone being like, I feel like developing this terrible vacant block. But no one has tracked it. And the Enquirer and the Business Courier, both on the year anniversary, tried to track it ourselves. It is almost impossible, because we looked at building values and
So you can see anecdotal evidence that
right.
this is happening.
And they tried to ask.
But statistical evidence
right.
is what's tough
they
to find.
They tried to ask everybody, and they kind of got some people saying yes. But I always go back to Kansas City. So they have a very similar streetcar to ours.
They open about the same time. They started their operation
they
around
the same
time.
They have the same weather. They have the same route around their downtown, the same length of track. And so it's a very similar project. It is free, so there's a big difference there. But from day one that they approved this project, every business that pulled a permit along the streetcar route, They said, are you doing this because of the streetcar? And so they actually can say, you know, this many billion dollars of development has been done because of the streetcar. And like, that's an amazing
they've
number.
They've analyzed it.
Right. And it's just not a number that we have here.
Yeah. Well, what are some other comparisons to how things have gone in Kansas City? I mean, and again, you're correct. They don't charge a fare, but...
Well, their management structure is the idea. They have like a board overseeing it. So it's like this one entity where everybody, you know, pretty much seems to be getting along. And so there's one place where decisions are made. And that seems to be like a way to smooth things over. Because the big difference is they have the same streetcar vehicles as us. And a big takeaway for me when I was looking at my own state of the streetcar was, why are their vehicles working and ours aren't? They're the same. It seems that CAF is actually fixing their cars, like immediately, whereas we are not getting the fixes as quickly.
It's a different dynamic in Kansas City, too. Yeah, I mean, you've got – the thing to remember here, too, is with all these problems going on, you still have a very divided council and political environment. You have a divided populace when it comes to the streetcar. Some people would just assume sit back and say, I told you so, then try to deal with the problems it's dealing with. And I don't think you have that dynamic in Kansas City from what
– No. I mean, it's just a project where everybody was on board. Everybody was making the decision at the same time. And everyone shared an opinion that we wanted a streetcar, which, as we know, is not the case here.
So how do you fix all this? I guess that's the huge question.
You know, I don't really know what the answer is. Opening up these contracts could change money dynamics and how much things cost. And that's kind of scary because that could be more, not less. And so someone is going to have to take control of this and be that one person. I don't know who that is.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, fixing some of these problems will likely cost money. And in the political environment we're in here and with a lot of the attitudes that we see, you know, about the streetcar going back years, that could be a pretty hard sell here, whereas it may not be such a hard sell in a place like Kansas City, where there's general acceptance, people generally like it, and people want it running well. And here, I think, you know, politically, there are people who don't care a whole lot, and, you know.
But after hearing the state of the streetcar information, how much attention do you think city council is going to give this now? How much of their attention do you think it has?
I think they do need to fix it because the problems are not going away. And you have to do something about it because they're going to have to approve a budget for it. If you don't fix the problems, they just cost money. And that's a hard sell without trying to say, well, I'm trying to fix the problem with these changes. You can't just approve more money. Even if that is the solution or not the solution, you have to at least be working on it. And Greg seems very serious about it.
Yeah, Greg Landsman. Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much, Sharon. And thank you, Dan.
Thank you.
I hope we explained that all okay with all the chief and the police department.
From the Cincinnati Inquirer, Sharon Coolidge, and also Dan Horn. Thanks for listening to this podcast of Cincinnati Edition. The producer was Pete Reitmeier. The assistant producer was Selena Reeder. Josh Elstro was the technical director. I'm Mark Caney.